There's this great blend of like old characters that you'll recognise from Sherlock Holmes novels and stories of old, and new ones that have been invented especially for the film, and it's a great fun watch for children and adults alike.
I think it's one of those films that can appeal to most age groups. If you like that kind of thing, if you like sort of classic detective stuff and people running about on trains in Edwardian England and marquises in peril and that kind of thing.
Millie Bobby Brown is really, really great in it, and there's kind of like a lot of fun stuff. I think if I was maybe an 8-year-old girl, then it would probably have been my favourite film from last year.
Hey everybody, and welcome to this episode of Flixwatcher Podcast. Today I'm joined by Claire.
Hello.
Patrick.
Hi there.
And Helen.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about Enola Holmes.
Thank you as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher. Hello film fans, welcome to Flixwatcher Podcast. Joining us remotely today we have Claire and Patrick. If you please could both say hello and tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Well, hi, thanks for having me on today. I'm Claire Barrett. I present the Money Clinic podcast, which helps people to solve their real life money problems. And I write a column every weekend for the Financial Times. Now, everything I do is very much geared at normal people, not finance geeks. And if you subscribe to my podcast, we've got episodes about things like the best way of saving up for your first home, how to handle problem debt, and lots and lots and lots about investing, which is one of my top topics. But the one thing you won't hear is any jargon. This is very much about demystifying finance for ordinary folks. And I'm a regular finance guest on LBC Radio with Eddie Mayer most evenings. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Claire B to find out what I'm up to. And away from the financial world, I like to relax by reading lots and lots of detective fiction.
So when you say, oh, and it's going to lean into this choice that we're going to talk about later, well, shortly, but Claire, we should say on your Twitter is Claire, spelled C-L-A-E-R, even though there's many different ways to spell Claire, but to find you on Twitter, C-L-A-E-R-B at...
Yes, on Twitter and Instagram. I changed the spelling of my name when I was 11 years old and went to secondary school and found out how many other people were called Claire, so I just wanted
to be
different.
Oh, so you did it yourself?
Yeah, and now I'm stuck with it. And the first story... The first story that I ever had published in the Financial Times, the sub-editors thought it was wrong, and so I got a phone call at home to check. But yes, that is how I spell my name.
And when you're talking about finance and money, and you're trying to put in intelligent layperson terms, does that include cryptocurrencies? Do you demystify that, or do you kind of stay away from that kind of...
No, I mean, it's very much what people want to know about. I mean, I think that there is a huge... surge of interest in any kind of investment that can be perceived as a get rich quick idea, because you know lots of people don't have very much money and they would very much like to have a lot, if anything, to get on the housing ladder, which has just become, you know, this enormous asset bubble preventing most ordinary people, even on quite high wages, from being able to own their own house. So I think very much I understand where the interest in crypto comes from, but what worries me is the complete absence of any form of regulations to protect people, and the way that people have really punted these kinds of investments online. I mean, since I did a podcast which mentioned crypto, I've had all kinds of coins send me messages over Instagram saying, if you mention our coin, you know, if people buy it, we'll give you a cut, you can get commission. I mean, there's all kinds of shady things like that going on. I wrote a column about it just because I want people to know, you know, this is who you're dealing with. I mean, I think with a lot of these so-called alternatives, if you want to get into it, I'm not saying like don't do it and never do it, but if you do it, like, don't bet your house on it. Do a small percentage of your portfolio in these risky things. You know, it is like gambling. You know, don't bet more than you can afford to lose.
Absolutely. Patrick, who are you?
Hi, so my name's Patrick Mills. I'm a bookseller. I'm based in Hackney in East London, and I specialise in crime and detective fiction. And this is how I know Claire, because she's one of my best customers. And in a way, it leads on to what we're going to talk about today, because they're both crime films, loosely speaking. So my shop's in the basement of an independent bookshop called Pays of Hackney, which is in Lower Clapton Road. And we just reopened to the public yesterday. We've had we've been spending a lot of time refurbishing it, getting it ready with COVID and the restrictions. So it's been a lot of work. But hopefully my section will be open again soon. So if anyone wants to come along to Pages and buy some secondhand books or buy some new books, then they'll be able to do that very soon.
Well, absolutely. And so, yeah, good. It's good to hear you guys are opening up again. And it's the 13th of April as we record this. So when you listen to this, whenever you listen to this, head over to the Pages of Hackney and or look at what they've got on offer.
Don't use Amazon.
Yeah, don't use Amazon. Go use your local independent bookshop. We also do deliveries in the local area. That's within E8, E5, E9. But I also have an online presence myself, where it's called Field Books, which is on Etsy. It's like an online store. And Instagram is at Fields Books. So, and you can check out the Instagram. There's a lot of books on there and a lot of book-related stuff for people interested in secondhand books, and especially crime fiction, classic titles, right up to newer stuff. So there's lots of stuff on there, a lot of interesting stuff to see on the Instagram and also on the online Etsy store.
Well, we'll link to those in the show notes, guys. Well, you guys both talked about enjoyment of crime, and we're here talking about an adjunct, I'd say, to one of the most famous crime characters in history. And that we're talking about Enola Holmes here, which is your choice, Claire. Can you tell us why you chose it? Although I can suspect why, surely. And also give us a synopsis in less than 60 seconds.
Sure. Well, when you asked me to come on your podcast, I thought, well, I can only talk about crime fiction because really that's all I'm interested in. There's lots of movies in this genre. So I just put Holmes into the Netflix search engine and that was how it came up. Now, this movie was actually released under lockdown. So it's gone straight to Netflix rather than being at the cinema, which is a great shame because it's a captivating subject. I mean, if you imagine Sherlock Holmes, but female, that's the best way of summing up this movie. It's actually the younger sister imagined of Sherlock Holmes, teenaged Enola Holmes, who lives in a ramshackle country mansion with her mother, another figure which was absent from the original stories from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So we've got Helena Bonham Carter playing the mother, and then we've got Millie Bobby Brown, who you might know from Stranger Things, is absolutely fantastic. As Enola, she's got no formal education whatsoever. Her mum teaches her all kinds of unladylike pursuits, like self-defence, blowing things up in chemistry lessons, playing ping pong across the dining table and smashing up all of the
Was it ping pong or
statues.
Proper tennis? It seems a bit more dangerous.
Yeah, so I think yeah. No, I think you're right there. Yeah, anyway, so paying no regard to all of the family history, but you know, being very interested in word games, especially because of course Enola, spelled backwards, means alone, which is a key part of the plot. But this has all been going on in the absence of Sherlock and his brother Mycroft, who are summoned back to the home when their mother strangely goes missing on Enola's 16th birthday. And the rest of the film is basically her quest to beat Sherlock, find out where her mother is. And along the way, she becomes embroiled with this other young teenage runaway, who's actually a Viscount, who's running away from his family for very different reasons. And they both end up in London on the wrong side of the tracks in Limehouse in the East End, pursuing...
Limehouse is the wrong side of the tracks up in there.
It probably still is. So I think he famously said you couldn't go beyond Limehouse without needing Watson's revolver. So there's this great blend of like old characters that you'll recognise from Sherlock Holmes novels and stories of old, and new ones that have been invented, especially for the film. And it's a great fun watch for children and adults alike.
It's a good family. Well, I think it's a nice modern family film, isn't it? Helen, what were your thoughts on Enola Holmes' initial thoughts and your thoughts on Sherlock in general.
I don't know whether I'm a massive Sherlock fan myself. I mean, I like the obviously the most recent BBC adaptation, and the Guy Ritchie films were fun. But further than that, I'm not one of I'm not one of the huge fans. So I'd never heard of the books that this is based on. So they're based on a series of young adult fiction, that this kind of series, which I imagine, probably due to the kind of success of this one, we'll probably see some more of those books. I didn't watch this when it came out. Not massively my bag. Just didn't really kind of, wasn't one of the ones top on my list. That said, like, Millie Bobby Brown is really, really great in it. And there's kind of like a lot of fun stuff. I think if I was maybe an 8-year-old girl, then it would probably have been my favourite film from last year.
What about yourself, Patrick? As a crime fan, how aware were you of these books, and how what's your kind of favorite interpretation of Sherlock?
I have to confess, I'm coming at it from as a big fan of Sherlock. When I was about 12 years old, I wanted to be Sherlock Holmes, but and that was when I was 12 years old. That was a very long time ago. There was some quite famous adaptations on ITV. With an actor in it. Claire and I have talked about this before, called Jeremy Brett. They were sort of the iconic ones when I was that age. But as Helen mentioned, these are based on more recent books. I think the woman who wrote them is called Nancy Springer. She's an American writer. And I had no knowledge of them prior to watching this. But I first watched it, I think it was about a year ago when it came out on Netflix. And I watched it with my nephews, who are both boys, and they're about 9 and 6 at the time. And the 9-year-old enjoyed it. I think it was a bit over the 6-year-old's head. But we all sat down and watched it, enjoyed it. I think it's one of those films that can appeal to most age groups if you like that kind of thing. If you like sort of classic detective stuff and people running about on trains in Edwardian England and marquises in peril and that kind of thing. So
for me, the marquises in peril.
Yeah. No, for me, it ticked a lot of boxes, and I enjoyed watching it again. The second time I watched it, I think I picked up on a few other things that I maybe didn't pick up on the first time. Obviously there's the fact that it's a female character makes it different from a lot of the other adaptations, and there have been many of them over the years, as I'm sure you all know. There's been lots of offshoots and spin-offs, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great fun.
I think it's important that we have more, I know it's important that we have more female led characters in all fiction, and it's a kind of a shame that it's a Sherlock Holmes kind of adjunct, but I want more and more female like characters in TV and film and books. And I love the way you said you watched it with your nephews, and the older one enjoyed it, and it wasn't because, oh my God, it wasn't put off because it was a girl, the lead. It was just this fun story. And I think we just need to have more of those and put in front of boys and girls to realize that female led characters can be awesome in the way that Enola is here.
I think it's important for young boys now to see, they can see girls in action films and see them in roles like that where they're not
just standard romance or wanting to be a princess when they grow up.
Although saying that, my two nephews are a little bit younger than Patrick's. They're 5-year-old twins, and they're obsessed with Frozen. Which is a Disney movie with two incredibly strong female characters, and they dress up as her at home. Don't see any problem with that. They've got a Superman and a Spider-Man suit as well. But I just think it's wonderful that they can relate to strong female characters as well as male superhero characters, and not sort of see any big difference between the two.
And that's it. There's a strong female character. I think Disney is up in their game with Moana, with Frozen, with Zootropolis, Zootopia, where the more female characters you have, non-male characters you have, it just becomes the norm, and you don't think twice. And people don't get pissed off when there's a Ghostbusters reboot with this fronted by women, or there's the first ever Marvel film featuring a female lead character is 20 films down the line. It should be like second or third or first in line because the people who push the coins around think it's people aren't going to watch it.
Children are less judgmental, it would appear. They're a lot more forgiving and a lot more willing to give things a try than men in their 30s, it would seem.
Or men in their 30s think people want. Well, and also, I guess, Millie Bobby Brown is great. And has everyone here seen Stranger Things?
Yeah, I've seen it. I think I've seen all of them.
It's not a series I got into, I must confess.
But I think there's a deep crime basis to it with a bit of science fiction and a bit of 80s nostalgia.
You could fit it into that sort of genre. I mean, Stephen King and there's good guys and bad guys. Although it isn't not strictly Stephen King, but it's based.
It's a melange of a lot of the different 80s. Yeah. There's definite It stuff in there and there's definite...
She's very clearly the standout star from that. I mean, I couldn't name any of the other Stranger Things actors apart from Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder.
But she's obviously an adult. But out of the children, she was definitely a standout for me. And she's a standout for this as well. I think I would have liked a bit more Helena Bonham Carter because she looked like she was having a lot of fun. I kind of felt that Henry Cavill was sort of phoning it in a bit. He was maybe... just kind of put there for maybe a big star. And I don't know. I thought he was a bit miscast. And Mycroft was a bit sort of one-dimensional as well. Or maybe it was just the fact that she was so outstanding that everyone else kind of paled a little bit. But it was a bit of a strange casting, I think, for me, as him as Sherlock.
I think kind of the way it's set up, I thought, was that she stands out more than the others. I think Henry Cavill for me is a bit of a strange casting because he doesn't strike me as Sherlock. Maybe I'm just used to seeing him in big action Superman type roles, and Sherlock, even though he does get into scraps in places, he's more
brains than brawn, isn't he?
Yeah,
there was none of the dark side of Holmes, you know, the drugs and the inner demons. He looked like he was, you know, come straight from an audition for a boy band.
This is the thing about Sherlock. One of my friends had to tell me that he was like addicted to morphine, and it's just basically a very, very loose canon. That's something I haven't seen much in the adaptations recently. I think maybe it's alluded to slightly, but it seems that kind of darkness is something why I feel I need to read the books to get that.
I mean, certainly not in this film, and perhaps appropriately, seeing as children are the main audience. But in Elementary, which is sadly no longer on Netflix, you have to go to the other streaming service beginning with the letter A to get that one. But Elementary is like the US version of Sherlock Holmes, and so for years I didn't watch it because I just thought, what are they going to do? This will be a travesty. But actually, Johnny Lee Miller of Sherlock is totally brilliant, and the way that they have explained the drug use there is that he is a recovering heroin addict in modern day New York, living in a brownstone his rich father has provided for him, and his sobriety coach and living companion is Dr. Joan Watson, so a female Watson played by Lucy Liu, which is an absolutely brilliant construct. And I think that there are 7 series of Elementary. Oh, okay. Certainly, it got me through the first lockdown. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
I know of that one. I've not watched it myself. I think when it came out, it kind of felt a little bit like what they did with House in that kind of way, where that sort of style. So, interesting how they managed to bring in a female into the sort of mythology of it in quite a clever way. I always thought that was quite a clever casting of Lucy Liu in that one.
Yeah, and without giving too much away, Moriarty, when she comes in, she, the arch criminal nemesis of Sherlock, is revealed to be a woman, which I also thought was fantastic. But it just works, you know, it's not something that feels contrived or a token sort of gesture. It just makes it, you know, it gives all of the stories a new lease of life. And like the BBC adaptations, which are on Netflix, the Benedict Cumberbatch ones, you know, there's just some fantastic, twisting of old plots and storylines in new ways that make it, frankly, a brilliant watch for anyone, even if they've never read the original Sherlock Holmes stories. But for people like me and Patrick who have, you know, pored over them and subsequent, fan fiction and, you know, read every single, you know, article or thing that they can get their hands on that mentions Sherlock Holmes. I even subscribe to Sherlock Holmes magazine. That's how sad I am. We can wring even more out of them.
This kind of begs the question, which is the first Sherlock book that you'd recommend people to get into, to get? So I remember reading Hand of the Baskervilles when I was very young, and everyone says that's not a Sherlock Holmes book. So which is a good first Sherlock book to read to get a flavour of?
Well,
before, maybe throw it to Patrick.
I would actually recommend The Hand of the Baskervilles to me. Oh, really? Yeah, it's the best long novel, apart from the short stories, which are good. But then the earlier ones are better than the later ones, because Conan Doyle got very fed up with having to bring him back from the dead and keep churning them out. So the later stories, not so good. But I always thought The Hand of the Baskervilles worked in terms of a novel and in terms of a longer, like a detective novel. The other novels that he wrote, I think he wrote three others, and they didn't work as well as The Hand of the Baskervilles. So I'd recommend that one.
Other people said to me, because he's not much time with Sherlock, so you don't get to see how his brain works as much, and he spends a lot of time on the moor.
He does quite a lot of other Sherlocky things, like dressing up as a tramp, and you know, nobody realizes it's him. Maybe the sort of the deduction aspect is less in evidence there, but I think it's quite atmospheric of the play, of the time and the place, and it's one of my favourite ones.
All right, I stand corrected. How many of you guys have seen? I know Helen's seen Fleabag. You, Patrick, and Claire have seen Fleabag.
I've love not seen Fleabag. Fleabag.
Well, I think Patrick, if you've not seen Fleabag,
I've not then watched it. I didn't catch that one at the time.
I think having seen how many Bobby Brown works in this is. There's a lot of it's all about breaking the fourth wall in the Fleabag way. And this was directed by the director behind Fleabag, Harry Bradbeer. And as I was going through, I was like, this reminds me of something. I know something about this film. And I was like, it's directed by the Fleabag. And you can see why he was put together, or why he, you know, pitched for this film or put it all together. Because there's a lot of, let's say Fleabag in the mannerisms and how the story develops. I was saying, Claire, you seemed to excited by that notion.
Oh yeah, I love Fleabag. Well, you know, as somebody who spent most of my 20s too drunk to remember what was going on, totally appeals to me. But the effect of, you know, those like asides direct to camera, which I think is just so compelling when Phoebe Waller-Bridge does them. It also reminded me of Gentleman Jack. I don't know if you saw that one on the BBC. So this is a historical adaptation, and again the lead character does those very jarring direct to camera pieces, which really add another element to the retelling historical stories. So there's definitely form for it. Whether he was directing that as well, I don't know. I'd have to Google it.
I loved Fleabag, but I wasn't 100% sold that I kind of felt that this worked in the best way, and to the point where it was a little bit distracting for me, as were some quite ropey scenes in
Enola Holmes. Yeah,
I think because of having seen Fleabag, the way it's kind of done there is very different, so my brain was obviously like going, okay, we're in a child's film, it's okay. And I don't know, it didn't work for me personally. And there was also some very very, very, very obviously CGI London, which was cracking off, which I always think is disappointing, considering, you know, you could make it look non-CGI as possible, which was a bit of a shame. It's always when the CGI pulls you out of enjoyment watching a film is a bit of a disappointment.
I didn't notice any of the CGI, so maybe I just wasn't paying attention enough.
Some of the buildings were, and the sort of more famous kind of skyline was a bit.
I think at one point they were in Somerset. It looked like Somerset House, and I know it looked a bit sort of too. The colours were quite bright, and possibly that was CGI. But yeah, I didn't notice too much of that.
I think there was one bit where they were supposed to be in Baker Street, but you had a clear and uninterrupted view of St Paul's Cathedral, and I did think,
slightly like, especially when you know London quite well and you're like, that's not right. And I think that's just from living in London and being quite familiar, that whenever I watch a film with anything that has any kind of London in it, if it's crazy and inaccurate, I'm like, and then I start looking where was it filmed and checking locations and how much was actually filmed in London, and that's when I'm like, I should be watching the film.
Yeah, so it was distracting from it. Yeah, I didn't notice. Well, I thought, you know, I was kind of engaged and just pulled through all the way. How does Mycroft compare to the character in the book? Because Mycroft is a character I didn't realize existed until Benedict Cumberbatch's. Again, I'm on Helen's side. I know super little. Knew very much they existed, but couldn't tell you much apart from the Hound of Baskervilles. And I didn't know that Mycroft was such a big character in the stories.
He wasn't. He was quite a minor character in the stories. He didn't really come into it so much. And he's seen as this very sort of ordinary, boring civil servant. Mm. And when he does come into the stories, which is pretty brief, fairly infrequently, he's usually, Sherlock's had to go to him to get some sort of official information because he works for the government or, but he's certainly, I found the characterization of him in this one a bit jarring because it wasn't sort of, it wasn't borne out by the character as he is in the books. But I mean, it's a minor quibble. They can do what they like with these, you know, they can use them as they see fit. It's fiction. It's sort of, and it is fan fiction. So I guess they can, yeah. They're allowed a certain license, shall we say.
Yeah, he wasn't given randomly. Well, not randomly. Bizarrely, Sherlock is the more compassionate of the two.
Yeah.
And again, I'm just comparing with the Benedict Cumberbatch version, where Mycroft is seen as almost more brilliant than Sherlock.
I can't remember how Mycroft came, how he was in the Benedict Cumberbatch
smug, self-satisfied. Right. Definitely like the sibling with the kind of superiority complex. I would say favoured son, whereas Sherlock's like the down and out druggie who's always been a bit of a problem. But it's amazing that people can build these characters in different ways because there was not very much information in the original stories about them. And I think it totally works to imagine that Sherlock Holmes might have had a younger sister.
Helen, you talked about lack of Helena Bonham Carter being in here. And what I really liked about her role and some of the ancillary characters, is it Susie Wacoma who was in this as well, is the suffragette, or I'm not sure if it's suffragette. I'm pretty much sure it's suffragette because they're the more terrorist and the bomb-making side than the suffragists were. Would have been good to see more of that, I guess. What are your thoughts, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they're thinking that they could have quite a young audience who might not be very au fait with the suffragette movement. And this is kind of like a bit of a thumbsucker introduction to it as well as to Sherlock Holmes. But I thought that it was really clever that, now I have to confess, I haven't read the Nancy Springer book, so I don't know if she tried to do it in the book and they copied it in the film or if the director just had the idea. But it's kind of the same point in history when Sherlock Holmes stories are being written anyway, and the suffragette movement is really building up ahead of steam. And I mean, it's quite amazing to think that it's only been a little over 100 years since women had the right to vote in the UK. Mm. And certainly that wasn't all women. You know, it was much later for women over 30. So this whole idea that the wonderful Edith, who has the front of a tea shop for her kind of like business of running self-defence and we suspect bomb-making classes, kind of like genteel English ladies. I thought that was a, you know, a really quite exciting idea. And the whole way that Enola Holmes, her character, has to grapple with the idea of not only that her mother has left her to pursue some kind of higher political aim, but also that, you know, she's doing something that's criminally wrong. You know, she's making bombs, she's trying to kill people, cause, you know, huge destruction to get publicity for the wider cause. So I thought it was quite clever to put those themes into the story when it is just so chock full of brilliant female characters for viewers of all ages to get hooked by. And I do hope that there are more films to come in the series. I'll certainly be watching.
Patrick, I don't know if you asked your older nephew this, if was he aware of what that kind of story, that part of the story was? And one of the reasons I asked this is because I remember watching, I used to watch Mary Poppins loads as a kid, and I was only watching it as an adult in my mid-30s. I was like, oh, right, there's a strong versus women kind of theme going through this, and Mrs. Banks is a staunch advocate of women's suffrage. Again, I'm not sure whether she's on the terrorist suffragette side or the suffragist side, but it's something I didn't pick up in the earlier stories, in the early watches.
I think it was when I watched it. I mean, it was a Saturday afternoon, and it wasn't something that we got into to sort of discuss later. But I mean, I think he must have been when you're that age, you are going to be aware of that. It's something that's going to come through that sort of political side to it. But one thing I noticed about him is that the stuff he studies in school is very different from the stuff I studied in school. He learns about different kinds of people, different areas of history that when I was at school just didn't, you know, we did, even at that age, you didn't really cover a lot of stuff. So I'd like to think that he would have a bit of background and a bit of knowledge of things like the suffragette movement, the movement for women's rights, colonial history, just different aspects that might come up in films like that, so that it's something that he's going to be aware of and have some knowledge of, if not direct experience of.
And again, in the same way of having female fronted films, it's good to have that kind of those kind of storylines woven into films that make it just the standard part of the conversation. Should we head to the scores?
Hello, folks. I'm Sam.
And I'm Martin.
And every week for the last 5 years, we've got together to talk about the musician Tom Waits.
He's a gravelly voice singer that sounded like he doused his vocal cords in bourbon and set fire to them with a cigarette and wrote such classic songs as Way Down in the Hole, Downtown Train, Jersey Girl.
He's also the gravelly voiced actor from films such as The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Seven Psychopaths, both of which coincidentally are on Netflix and both of which Kobe and Helen have discussed here on FlixWatcher.
So make sure you check those episodes out. And when you have a little bit of a taste for the magic that is Tom Waits, why not head over to songbysongpodcast.com or search for Song by Song in your podcatcher of choice to listen to a little bit more about Tom Waits.
Let's head to the spreadsheet of dreams, where the scores are locked tightly forever in our spreadsheet. All of the scores are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish, and we'll start with you, please, Claire, with your recommendability.
Oh, definitely a 5. I think that anyone could watch this and enjoy it.
Patrick?
I'd say 5 for recommendability, definitely.
Wow, coming out of the gate strong here. Helen?
I'm a little bit lower. I think its audience is quite specific in that it's definitely going to appeal more to kind of a younger audience than maybe a kind of older, more broader audience. I think for me, it was quite long and some of the sort of pacing was a little bit too long and not for me, I think. I enjoyed watching it, but it's whether I'd be that inclined to go out and seek the other ones from this, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure kind of parents will find it kind of a welcome thing to put on and watch with them. So I'm going to go for 3.7.
I'm going to go for 4. I was looking forward to watching it when I heard it came out. And I'm not sure why I didn't at the time. I think there's just other things going on. And I think, as Helen said, I think it's a touch long for the target audience, but I don't think it skews as young as Helen possibly thinks or feels. I think I was super happy watching it, and I do put it very much in the family camp. And I think if you have any slight interest in Sherlock Holmes and other kind of ancillary stories, then definitely search it out. Repeat viewing score, Claire.
Oh, well, I've only watched it once, but there are so many things in it that I think I missed that Patrick's mentioned. I definitely feel I should watch it again. And also, if you do play films to young children, as you know, they often want to watch them many times. So, yeah, I would say 4.5.
Oh, wow. Patrick?
I'd probably say 4. For that, I watched it twice, and the second time I watched it, I definitely got stuff out of it that I didn't notice I wasn't noticing the first time round. Possibly I wasn't paying too much enough attention the first time round, but I think it's something that stands up to a couple of viewings. Yeah.
So was that 4?
4.
Helen.
I'm probably less inclined to visit it, mainly because it's quite a long one, and my list of films are getting longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. But that said, if someone hadn't seen it and I went round and they said, do you want to watch it? I wouldn't say no, I don't think. So I'll go down the middle, 2.5.
Yeah, I'm going to get 2.5. I'm not sure when I'll watch it again. Probably, yeah, happy to do so, but I can't think it'll be a frequent rewatch for me. Small screen score, Claire.
Ooh, that's a good one, because most of the Sherlock things that we've been watching in recent years have been on the small screen, and they have been shorter, about 45 minutes to an hour. But this is kind of divided into two halves, the story. So I definitely think it could work on the small screen. And seeing as it was a cinema release that went straight to Netflix, I think that that could definitely be the way for future ones. So I'm guessing 4.
You're guessing 4?
Sorry. I am saying 4, decisively and authoritatively.
Patrick?
I think for the small screen, I mean, the first time I watched it was on a bigger screen, well, a large television, and second time was on a laptop. I think, yeah, it works pretty well on the small screen. I'd probably say 3 out of 5 for that.
Okay. Helen?
So this obviously came out during kind of peak lockdown, wasn't it? So I was interested to find out a little bit more of this. So in its debut weekend, it was the second most watched item on Netflix. The top one was Ratchet. And over its first 5 days, it was the most watched film on Netflix and would go on to become the biggest first day opening Netflix title in 2020. So a lot of people watched it.
What date was it released in on Netflix? What month?
It doesn't give me a date. Oh, hang on. September 2020.
Okay, so it wasn't like right at the point when people... No. I guess this is when people were... Films are kind of coming back to cinema, but also then weren't. So this is... And some films were coming out with it, were paid for, like Mulan, for example. So I can kind of see that why that happened.
But even more, so it's ranked 7th on Business Insider's biggest Netflix original movies of all time with 78 million viewership. So a lot of people watch this. So it's pretty clear they're probably going to ramp it up for another one. So another one may be incoming. I'm kind of a bit mixed on this because it feels very much like it would be quite suited to the cinema, and that I imagine going to the cinema with a group of children, not my own, borrow them for the afternoon, would be quite a riotous affair. But that said, I mean, that many people watching at home, it's kind of like, well, maybe it is suited for them. I'm going to go for 4.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get quite high here. 4.5 for me. I think it's perfectly great for watching at home. Yeah, like I said, I think it's one of the things will be like a Sunday family film, sit down and watch it kind of thing. And I don't think the special effects were that great. There wasn't much in the soundtrack. So yeah, I'm going to go for 4.5. Engagement score, Claire?
Yeah, I would give it a very high engagement score. I didn't want to press pause at any point. So yeah, 4.5.
Patrick?
I found it fairly engaging. It wouldn't have stopped me from pausing it and going to make a cup of tea or something like that. I think because it's fairly, and for the most part, it's quite lighthearted. It's not something that sort of grips you on the edge of your seat. It's something you sort of go along with. So probably engagement, I'd say about 3.5, I think, for me.
Helen?
Yeah, it's one of those that you can kind of definitely have sort of in the background and zone in a bit further when the kind of action points or key points get in there. There was a bit sort of the middle where she's looking for, what's his name, Tewksbury. And it kind of, I felt like I really wanted the story to kind of move on a little bit faster. And it's just the pacing in it. The pacing is it wasn't quite right, I don't think, for me. I thought they could have made it a bit more, just liven things up a little bit. So I'm going to go with Patrick with a 3.5 on engagement.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a 4 here. I think I did watch it in a couple of chunks. And one thing I found is that you need to be looking at the screen because it's quite easy to miss things like going into that the warehouse and Limehouse, and you have to pay attention to see there's that purple ribbon on the lock, for example. So it's things like that you could probably miss. And I think this is maybe where Patrick said on second watching, you picked up things he didn't do the first time. So I think if you're going to watch it, then you need to be somewhat engaged. If you're looking at, I think if you're looking at Twitter, you'd miss out a lot of the different things. So I'm going to go for a 4. And that gives us an overall score of 3.88750, which is fairly decent, which is fairly decent. I think lost a few points on repeat viewing, mainly. Should we head over to Twitter? Guys, do follow us on Twitter. We are at FlixWatcherPod. And one of the main reasons to follow us is because we do put a shout out asking for your engagement on the film before we go into recording and put out tweets like this. We're reviewing Enola Holmes with Claire B from the FT Weekend and Patrick Mills from Pages of Hackney. Have you seen it? Give your thoughts and your score out of 5 stars for an on-air shout out. We had a couple of responses. Claire, do you want to pick one?
Stephen Lockeridge replies to your tweet. Great fun, good performances, especially Millie Bobby Brown, agree there, and Henry Cavill, disagree. But it does seem to be setting up for something bigger. 4 stars, he says.
Yeah, it seems like there wants to be more there, certainly. And if there's more books, then, you know, why not? Patrick?
Yep, I've got one from Lee Thomas, who says, very fun, interesting addition to the Holmes catalogue. Millie Bobby Brown is excellent in the role and I'd happily watch more. 3.5 stars.
Yeah, kind of tallies with what we were saying here. Awesome. Thank you very much, guys. Can you quickly tell everyone who's listening where they can find you online and we'll say goodbye to all the fans?
Sure. If you want to follow me on Instagram and Twitter, I'm at Claire B, which is spelled C-L-A-E-R-B because I spell my name in a funny way, but people remember it. And my podcast comes out every Tuesday. It's called Money Clinic with Claire Barrett. And you can subscribe to that wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find me at Fields Books on Instagram. That's lots of stuff, different books and book-related stuff on there. And also on Etsy, the online shop, there is a Fields Books store on there. So have a look on there and first book, second-hand books for sale.
Guys, thank you so much for spending time and watching Enola Holmes for this podcast and for this episode. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming on. Bye.
Bye.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell him FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.